What is the best advice you can give somebody who is going to go the postdoc route? What would you give them?
I would suggest that you spend a good bit of time thinking about what you want to do after the postdoc, because that's going to be a big indicator of where you should be trying to go for the postdoc. So, you know, if you want to go into academics, while some people are in exceptions, for the most part, you kind of have to go to a big name school and you kind of have to work for somebody with a big name if you want to be a professor, especially an R1, you know.
What's up, everybody? It's the Don't Be Scared podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. J. This podcast is all about STEM education, all right? And once again, STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. So if you're interested in any of these subjects, this is your podcast. Now, specifically during this podcast, we're going to be talking about careers, education, and any trends that we see happening in STEM education right now. Hey, everybody, this is Dr. J, and we're back with another interview at the Don't Be Scared podcast. And once again, this podcast is all about highlighting STEM leaders in our field. And today we got a very special guest. We have Dr. Drew Hood, all right? And once again, Drew is a very, very smart person. Dr. Hood definitely has taught me a lot of different things. We were actually lab mates in the same lab. So today we're really just going to dive in and see just about his journey and see what we can learn from him today. So Drew, how you doing today, man?
I'm pretty good, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So one thing that I would just like everybody to know is what's your background? You actually have an interesting background. Math, right? Did you start in math and then you kind of transitioned? Can you explain more about that?
Yeah. So I finished high school and I went to undergrad, right? And I started off in biochem, thinking, want to do biology stuff.
Okay.
And, so I started out in that, took some biochem classes, took some chemistry and some math classes like you have to. I was always pretty good at math, you know? So I ended up taking a few more math classes than I intended to in the beginning. And I got to my fourth year in undergrad and it was like, okay, I need to graduate, right?
Yeah.
I had basically been just taking, I took like biochem, molecular biology, I took like a bunch of chemistry classes, inorganic, physical, took a bunch of math classes. And when I got near the end, I ended up choosing, okay, if I'm going to finish out an undergrad, I finished out my math undergrad. So,
gotcha.
That's basically what happened, man. Yeah, I couldn't choose, everything's related. And I really just enjoyed learning about all the different fields. And in the end, I just went with the one I was closest to that I thought would be the most useful for undergrad. So I ended up doing
that. Yeah.
But since I worked in a lab.
Yeah.
Yeah. So since I worked in a lab in undergrad, though, a chemistry lab, right, while I was taking all those chemistry classes, I decided I'll do a chemistry PhD. Because when grad school time came around, I was like, oh, what should I go for? I could go for math. But honestly, when you get to high-level math, it's kind of boring. So,
okay. Don't miss another math people out there.
No. It's just not for me, right? It's not my cup of tea. I kind of like hands-on stuff. I like to do something with my hands and see those results instead of just
Was that the factor that made you ultimately choose chemistry over math? Was just based on the math, or was there like anything else that because you mentioned hands-on, is that the main reason, or? What was another reason why you chose? Because it's still STEM, right? But it's like math versus science is something that we always hear. So what ultimately made you go even chemistry in that regard than math?
It was definitely the hands-on aspect. So, in math, you write a lot of proofs. You do a lot of statistical analysis. And that can be fun and it can be rewarding. But working with your hands and you're physically, adding chemicals together, watching them change, collecting samples, collecting data that way.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? It's more rewarding. It's a little bit like the difference between writing a book and building a desk. You know, there's like a physical thing there, and it's more rewarding in that regard.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you like to, that just, that whole feel of it better than just, you know, that mouth side. And yeah, I definitely get that. Two different types of areas to look at, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah.
So
they're just better for certain people, you know?
Yeah. No, exactly. And in your case, you liked chemistry. So when you got to grad school, right, your background, you was kind of feeling biochem, but as I know, but I'm pretty sure you're going to tell the audience, like, you ended up in inorganic chemistry. So what ultimately led you the inorganic route, which, once again, everybody, inorganic chemistry is not really, I don't know, what do you feel like, Drew? Is it really out there that people know about it, or is it something that you kind of just learned?
I feel like it's not something you know about. So when you take your undergrad courses, you only take one inorganic course potentially, right? You take two organic or more. You take two PChem or more, you know, but there's only usually one inorganic class, period, in the whole undergrad curriculum, you know? So it's much more.
I didn't take one in my case.
Yeah, I took one, man. I took one. I actually took a polymers class, too, in undergrad. So I had just as much polymer background as inorganic, you know? and that you would think that would not be the case, but, you know, it's there's just not much inorganic in undergrad.
Yeah.
But for me, so when I came in, actually, the department was trying to get me to go PChem because I had the math background, right? Mm. And that would have been nice. They actually had one guy who was doing laser stuff, and that would have been kind of cool, too.
Yeah.
Still kind of hands-on, you know, and collecting data. But when I started interviewing people and I started kind of seeing what labs were doing, I ended up meeting George, our advisor, right?
Mm.
And he was just such a great – he had a great personality, right? Lab looked interesting. The chemistry seemed a little bit more interactive, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It seemed like there was more potential there for who knows what could happen, you know, unless, just cookie cutter out. We'll see what, you know, we know where we're going. We know what we're going to collect. I felt like there was more inspiration or wonder behind the stuff that, you know, was it going on in that lab. Me personally, anyway.
Okay.
And so that really drew me to it because I was like, oh, well, who knows what kind of crazy stuff we could find.
Exactly.
The laser thing was real straightforward. It was, you're going to collect data. Here are the numbers. This is what the numbers mean. Whereas I feel like in the inorganic lab, at least George's lab, it was much more of a journey. Like, oh, we don't know where we're going. we'll see what we find, you know.
You're right about that. It was a journey.
Yeah, it was a journey, man, you know. And for me, that was kind of what I always liked about science, was not really knowing, you know, the destination. You start learning stuff, and you never know where it's going to take you. And that's what I liked about George's lab. And that's kind of why I went with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And Drew, can you, like, you don't have to get too technical, I guess, but can you just, like, give a quick summary of the research you were particularly doing when you were in graduate school?
Yeah, sure. I could even give some of my postdoc work too, if you want. In graduate school, we were working on a reaction called hydroformylation. Mm-hmm. And so it takes olefins or alkenes, which are oil field products, right? And it converts them into aldehydes. And the aldehydes are really just intermediates that they use to make all kinds of other things. So it's something called a bulk chemical. So it's something they make on a large scale as an intermediate to make other useful chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
The main things that they make out of the aldehydes are alcohols, carboxylic acids, and occasionally they'll use the aldehydes to make fragrances or flavorings as well.
Okay.
And the alcohols and the carboxylic acids are mainly used to make plasticizers and potentially plastics themselves or machining oil. And so it's really just a bulk chemical that they use for everything.
Yeah.
What we were interested in is making a new catalyst for it so that you could make the aldehydes either under lower pressure, under lower temperature, you can make them faster, or maybe you could just turn over some that were kind of difficult to react with the current technology, right?
Yeah.
And so to do that, we got to work with these batch reactors, which were real cool, these Paul reactors. We got to use air-free techniques on Schlenklines and glove boxes, you know? Got to work with organometallic complexes. And that's
crazy stuff.
Complexes that have, it has a metal, and then it has all these organic things attached to it, right? And so the metal kind of brings the organic stuff together and makes something cool happen, and then out you get something new, right? And it was really cool, man, really cool. And we ended up publishing on it. We ended up coming up with a new cobalt technology. It's got patent.
Right? Yeah,
you know, Ryan's on the patent too. Yeah. And it was quite the journey, man. We had a blast doing it. I felt like we learned a lot, and we got to experience a lot of cool ups and downs, you know, that not everybody gets, but I think a lot of people can relate to that.
And especially. Especially when you say just journey, man, it's just, your research, it is a journey, like how you look at it, right? Because it's like, you know, in our case, our advisor, it had been a process of like, that project was like, you had two or three other people working on it, but, you know, they had their own journey, and then eventually to where then you take over, then it's another journey, you know, to where it just continues to go. Even now, I mean, the research is still being looked at. To where people still looking at the paper in that regards, and still being continued. So, and that's the thing about research. It's like a legacy in a way, right? To where it's like you're just researching over on a certain subject, but you're giving back to the community in that type of regard. So, yeah, it's crazy how research can be applied, right? And then speaking of that, right? So you ended up in grad school, and then can you explain, the process of after grad school and in that whole world? Like, because, you know, people usually think like, you know, you get your PhD and then that's it. But there's a whole thing called postdoc, right? So can you tell the people like, what is a postdoc first off? And then what exactly does that mean to be a postdoc?
Yeah, sure. No, I'd be happy to. So whenever I finished grad school, after I got my PhD, me and Ryan graduated together. And I actually had an offer for an industrial job in Texas. But it was for a smaller company, and it wasn't quite where I wanted to live. Mm. And it was really just continuing to work on hydroformylation, right?
Yeah.
So I was looking, you know, as a scientist, as somebody who likes adventure, I was wanting to do something different.
Yeah.
And so I ended up passing on that opportunity, and I ended up doing the postdoc instead. So the postdoc's not necessary for you to move along the job, you know, a career track, whatever you want to do, but it does help a lot for certain career tracks, right?
Gotcha.
And so I wanted to do it because it would help me get into like a little bit better industrial position in the future, and or it helped me get into being a professor. Right. So whether I wanted to do the industrial or the academic, the postdoc helps you get there in some regards, depending on the position you're applying for. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up getting a postdoc. So now I'm currently at Rice here in Houston.
Okay.
And I'm working for a young professor, actually, which is quite different. So as we mentioned, you know, me and Ryan graduated together. Our old advisor was old. He was retiring. He's not that old, but you know what I mean. He was on retirement. He retired when we finished, right? So the lab was done when we were gone. And so I wanted a nice change of pace. I was like, I wonder what it's like to work for somebody at the beginning, right? So something called pre-tenure, before they have their position is permanent, right? So I went to go work for him. He was only in his second year when I joined. And so I joined the group, you know, hoping to build up my resume for that next position, hoping to gain some new experiences working at a different university for a young professor, working in a different area of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really been quite the experience, man. So I started up the postdoc. I work on photocatalysis now mainly. That is some nickel photocatalysis where you combined, it's called aerylation, where you kind of basically put an alkyl group onto an aromatic substitute.
Substitute.
Mm-hmm. And so it's quite interesting. It's different, a lot different than hydroformylation.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I've had to spend a whole lot of time helping set up the lab. It's been a whole another experience.
Yeah. And talk about that as far as because you said setting up lab, and in grad school we kind of have to do this, but is it different, I guess, for a postdoc setting up lab and your, like, how's that responsibility, right? To where it's like postdoc and then how you work with graduate students. How was that? Because you had to set up your lab. So what was that process like?
Right. Yeah, it's much different, man. So the professor's still not in the lab. Like when we were grad students, George was never in the lab. We just went into the lab and we were trained by other grad students, right? Well, since this lab is so young, there are no senior grad students. There are only me and there were two other postdocs. They both have left and moved on to other jobs at this point because they started a year before me. So they've already finished out their contract. And basically, I'm the senior person in the lab, aside from the professor, right? I'm the most senior person.
Okay.
And so unless the professor trained them how to do something, I got to be the one training them how to do something. And like you said, there's definitely a different layer of responsibility. Whenever you're a grad student, no one expects you to know anything, you know, until you get to be a more senior grad student. And certainly no one expects you to be the one responsible to set things up. But when you're starting out as the postdoc, it's like, oh, no, you should know how to do things. I'm leaning on you to get things done. And so, like for example, the group I'm in now has two GCs and an LCMS, right? When I joined, none of it was set up at all. None of the instruments were working. None of them were calibrated. None of them, nothing. Man.
Yeah.
And so it was up to me to step in and go, all right, well, let me crack my knuckles and get in on this. and now they're all working. Like I've got them all up and running. In fact, I've even, one of the students, she has a project with some asymmetric work that I have the LCMS set up for her. Several other ones with their smaller projects with the GCs and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's definitely on you to help get everybody else where they need to be with their projects, right? With
the stuff
they're working on.
Very true. Yeah.
And they do
very
come true. To you constantly like, oh, what do you suggest about this? What do you suggest about that?
Yeah.
So you really have to, you get tested a lot. It's like, oh, do you know what you're talking about?
you have to.
You got to pull on that experience from grad school to really help people out.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's very true because it's like you're like teaching, mentoring in a way, right, to the next graduate student trying to figure it out.
Right. And I enjoy that, honestly, Ryan. Like, I go to them constantly and ask how the things are going. You know, have you tried this? Have you tried that? You know, just trying to help. It helps so much just having somebody to talk to about your research and to speak about, to talk through it out loud, as I guess.
Exactly.
I know for me and you, back when we were grad students, that was one of the key things that helped, you know, you work through problems, just talking about it with somebody else,
bouncing
ideas off of them. You know, and just having somebody else give you the ear to be like, oh, no, I think that's good. I think that's bad, you know.
Yeah. And I definitely agree because some things that usually, you know, what I always like to tell people is like we undervalue how much collaboration there is in chemistry. I personally feel like, right, just how you mentioned, like we were constantly talking, communicating, collaborating in some type of form on our projects that we had. And it's like people downplay the collaboration effort that's happening in lab. You know, think about all these papers that we constantly publish. Can you remember last time you seen a big name paper without 20 people on there, right? Or at least five or something like that? I've never seen a paper with just one name on there. Yeah. So it's
that's very often.
Exactly. So I definitely feel like if you're going into this world, I feel like people should be definitely open to collaborate. And unfortunately, I feel like they don't learn that until you actually start doing research, right? Because in lecture, it's not really that type of form. But definitely, as you see, collaboration is going to be a key thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Drew, you have a variety of different... So, math degree, inorganic, and then photocatalyst. Like, who exactly is your inspiration? Like, who inspired you to even want to pursue this whole field?
Honestly, man, I can't really say anybody in particular, right? Like, I had some really good teachers in high school, actually. I took like AP chemistry and I took calculus from that and stuff. And they, I had some really good teachers in high school that got me interested, right? Because they were good at teaching the subject. And then when I got to college, just getting that hands-on experience with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Really made me realize, oh, I actually really like this. This is fun. Yeah. You know, it's something I don't mind waking up and going to do every day. Like, I don't dread going to work, so I can't complain, you know?
Yeah, well, that's true.
So to me, that's a win, man, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good thing. I feel like, you know, definitely always enjoy what you do. Like, if you're not enjoying what you're doing, then, you know, it, I always tell people, consider something else. I mean, because you don't necessarily have to do that, you know? So my question to you, Drew, is, so you explained postdoc, what is something like someone who is considering a postdoc, right? What is something that they wouldn't think about, right? What is something that, you know, the average person isn't thinking about with their postdoc position?
Most people, I think, are not thinking about the timelines. That's one thing I think that people don't consider enough of. So you join, it's normally a 2-year contract. If you can get more funding, it could turn into longer, right? 3, 4, 5 years. one of the guys in the lab who just finished, he moved on, right? It was his 6th year. He was a postdoc for 6 years. It can be a long-term thing if you want it to be. I don't suggest that. But, you know, you have to keep an eye on those timelines because it's always around the corner. You know, 6 months, you'll be half an hour for new jobs, or, you know, a year from now, more funding, or there's always something around the corner that you have to keep one eye out for. It's not just what's going on today, this week. It's what's coming in 6 months or a year. You got to be.
Yeah. So more strict timelines, more just overall. So would you? Well, now that you experienced undergrad, graduate school, and postdoc, what would you say was like the most, I guess not difficult, but like which one was the most time sensitive to where it's like you had to be on it? Because I'm pretty sure, at least for me, undergrad, I was not on it. I was just kind of chilling, you know, ethics and stuff. But I was so like, out of those 3 hours, what do you think?
Yeah. No, man. So I'll just walk you through it because I'm kind of from the same background, you know. Like I mentioned in undergrad, I took my time. I took, you know, senior level courses and everything, basically, you know. And I was like, oh, I'll get there when I get there. No big deal. And that's fine. In grad school, I still didn't feel like there was much of a time crunch because, again, you can graduate kind of whenever. You have a lot of flexibility, right? But postdoc, I'd say, it's definitely, you got to be on top of it because
different level.
The funding can run out in a year. You know, you can miss a good job because you weren't ready for it. You didn't have all your materials ready or you weren't keeping an eye out for it, you know?
Yeah.
I would say the other thing is once you get to the postdoc, you have to know what you want to do. You have to have narrowed it down. You know, in undergrad, most people, they're in a field they like, but they don't really know what they want for a career, right?
Exactly.
You go to grad school, you have some idea, but you can ask any grad student who's in their 3rd or 4th year, what do you want to do after this? And most of them will tell you, I don't know, man. But by the time you get to the postdoc, you have to know. You have to at least know, okay, I'll take this job and not that job, because it's to the point where you can't really put it off any longer.
Yeah.
You have to get into some career in order to move up and to make, you know, get where you need to be in 5-10 years.
Mm.
You can't meander too much, because otherwise you'll probably miss on an opportunity you want or need, and or you'll have to settle for something you didn't really want if you don't.
And what would be your, like, what would be your advice for like a grad student, like right now, and their, 3rd or probably 4th year, and, you know, they're on the brink of graduation, trying to get in their PhD, they're about to be a doctor, but they're considering postdoc. What is the best advice you can give somebody who is going to go the postdoc route? What would you give them?
I would suggest that you spend a good bit of time thinking about what you want to do after the postdoc. because that's going to be a big indicator of where you should be trying to go for the postdoc. So, you know, if you want to go into academics, while some people are in exceptions, for the most part, you kind of have to go to a big name school and you kind of have to work for somebody with a big name. If you want to be a professor, especially at an R1, you know, even an R2.
Okay. So real fast, Drew, can you explain to the people what exactly an R1, R2, and R3 is, just in case they don't know?
Yeah, no, of course. So an R1 and an R2 are distinctions made by Carnegie Mellon, and basically they're just levels of research output. So the highest level is an R1, and that's going to be most of your big state schools. That's going to be Harvard, MIT, Caltech, Princeton, you know, those places. Mm-hmm. And then R2 is the level below that, where they still offer PhDs and they still have a lot of research, but they probably don't quite have as many papers coming out. Their faculty and their departments are slightly smaller. And that's going to be, you know, your smaller state schools and a couple of more private schools that are a little bit on the smaller side, like University of Rhode Island, like Texas. Texas has a few too. But yeah, you'd have to look. They have a whole list online you can actually find. Okay. And then R3 are the ones below that. Now, those are all places that offer PhDs. And if you want to go, they have PUIs, which are primarily undergraduate institutions, which are places that really only offer undergraduate, sometimes master's degrees. So that's kind of the distinction.
Okay. Okay, cool.
Be at one of those R1s.
Yeah.
You kind of have to come from a big name lab. It's just kind of how it works. You can, if you don't believe me, go look at all the people who are professors at these R1s. You won't find too many that aren't from a big school or a big name lab. That's just
how it works. Yeah.
If you're interested in other careers like teaching and other things, then you have other opportunities that you might want to consider. Mm-hmm. Like being a visiting professor or being a teaching postdoc. They actually do have a few of those too.
Yeah. And I guess that's where I could say that's the type of route I went. I went to visiting professor route and then ended up in like that. So yeah, and then that's the crazy thing about this. So many, you know, when you only think about grad school and then you think PhD and you think that's it, that's not it, because it's like it's so many avenues that you could take out of this. It's good. It's a good thing, but then it's also, it can be overwhelming if you're not, as you said, focused on whatever you're trying to do, right?
Yeah, you just need to decide, you know. You need to sit down and really think about it before you're fumbling trying to get everything together so that you can get on track, you know.
Yeah.
And it's never too late to change either. I'll say that as well. You know, like my wife's a teacher. She works with some people who were in industry for years, and then they decided the hustle and bustle wasn't worth it anymore, and they decided that they'd go be high school teachers now. You know, so that's one of the beauties of science. Like you said, you have so many options, and rarely are you pigeonholed. You know, you can almost always shift gears a little bit. You know, not everything's available to you, but you definitely have options at any given time to say, you know what, I feel like I'm trying something different. So
Exactly. And trying something different, doing something new, is something that I always am preaching, you know, not to be scared, go out there and do whatever you have to do, right? But what is a moment in your time that you can probably say, all right, you had to take a chance on yourself, right? When's the moment that you can look back and say, all right, that moment was, I'm glad I decided to be brave in that moment, and because it's really benefited me. Do you have a moment like that in your STEM career?
Actually, I do, yeah. Whenever we finished grad school, right? So going to grad school first, you got to take a little bit of a chance on yourself, because, you know, there are times when it might not pan out as well as you want, you know. But take that chance on yourself to invest that time. Well, then whenever we finished, like I had mentioned, I had that job offer at the industrial job, right? Well, I didn't have an offer in hand from anything else at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to bet on myself, and I said, you know what? I think I can do better. I can get into a position that will help me in the long run more. And so I passed on that job, even though it was there. And and it took me a little bit of time, probably another 6 months or so to get the other job. But in the end, it was worth it. Because, you know, now I'm working at a fancier university in a lab that I think will open up more opportunities for me versus if I would have gone the other route.
Yeah.
And that was one of those moments where I had to just bet on myself and say, you know what, I think I can do something that will be better for me.
Mm.
And it worked out in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. it did. And that's something that we always should just preach to everybody. Right. Just go for it, guys. Because if it's not that, then what else? Right. I definitely see that. So now that Drew, you are as your postdoc, what are you considering after that? As far as like where would you want to go from that?
So I'm open to a lot of things. I'm actually not super particular. As long as I can still do some research, as long as I can be involved in science, I'm quite happy. I would be happy to go industry. But I'll say the thing is, if you want to go industry, it's a lot of time. It's a lot of work. Like me and Ryan actually worked with people in industry. We collaborated with Dow and Exxon while we were grad students. They work a lot. It's a hard job. They work a lot. Yeah. So
yeah, you do.
The other route is I actually would really like even getting a position at a PUI, as I mentioned earlier, primarily undergraduate institution. Where I could train students and do a little bit in the lab, but not too much, you know, and then I get my, at least part of my summers off, I get all my holidays off, you know, and there's a trade off with everything, man, you know, no job is perfect, but you got to find what fits best for your lifestyle that you want.
Exactly.
So I'm quite flexible. I'd be happy with either. And it's really a matter of what's the best one that comes my way.
You know? Yeah, and I definitely agree with that. Because it's, I feel like as you know, right now in this period of time we live in, it's all about whatever lifestyle you want. You know, you have, you can do it. You can literally do this lifestyle, whatever you want to do. So I definitely agree with that. And then I guess what is the best advice you can give to somebody who's in the high school right now? Trying to go this route, what is something that, like, what would you tell yourself when you were in high school? What would you give your advice to? What would you tell them?
Yeah, my advice to myself would be, so I'd look out for two things. One, you know, take all your classes, find what you like. So you got to like what you do. If you don't like what you do, then it's going to be terrible, right? No one wants to go to a job they hate. So make sure it's something you like. Yeah. I will warn you that there's a lot more writing in science than you think. I've had to help write quite a few grants, you know. So there's more writing than you'd expect, but the science is fun. The other thing I would say is if you go into a scientific field, you do have to be realistic about job opportunities. And so I do a little bit of research, ask around, make sure you're in the hot area, right? The hot topic, whatever that may be. Make sure you're in the right area so that whenever your time comes around, the jobs will be there and you won't be specialized in a field that there really aren't too many opportunities. Because that can happen if you don't care. So those are my two bits of advice.
And good advice, everybody. Definitely good advice. So everybody take notes with that one. But I got to say thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hood. Thank you, Drew, for just coming in today and giving us your knowledge, man. Definitely appreciate it. It was definitely worth it. Do you have anything that you would like to just say to our audience to end with?
I would just say if you're thinking about getting involved in science, then get involved. I think science is one of the best things you can do for a career. You know, one of the things I love most about being a scientist, sure, I love working in the lab. I love the flexibility that comes with a lot of the positions. The money's not bad. But you know what else? I feel like I'm helping, as you were saying earlier, build technology, build a future. You know, I'm helping contribute to something that's going to be a legacy for all of time, right? I mean, like we still use stuff that people invented 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. So,
you know, I really take a lot of pride in the fact that, you know, I'm helping contribute to make the world a better place one day, even if it's only a small amount, you know, it's still not.
Well, thank you so much. Everybody, let's give it up for Dr. Hood. And this is our episode of Don't Be Scared, the podcast. Now, once again, you want to make sure that you hit that subscribe button and follow us for the latest episodes on our podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to leave a review as well as comment below what you want to hear us talk about next. At the end of the day, everybody, we're just here to help. We want to spread our vision of increasing STEM participation from underrepresented communities